leader of our time? And that is a great question. How did he go from that young rebel to such a business visionary?
Well, when he was a young man, he had numerous talents. You know, obviously, I mean, he was a brilliant young man. And he discovered early on that what he was he was an enabler of genius. He and Steve Wozniak created the Apple II and ushered in the world of personal computing. And then about in 1984, he created the Mac along with a really brilliant team of programmers and engineers. And he really was able to rally these guys and motivate them and do, you know, some amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't sustain it. He was a very divisive guy. He became, you know, he founded Apple when he was in his just turned 20. You know, he's very young, 20, 21. And, you know, he made a lot of mistakes when he was young. And then he made so many mistakes that he got kicked out of the company that he founded.
Wow, which says a lot right there. For 12 years, as probably most people know, and then he went back. But in those 12 years, he did an awful lot. But I do want to go back to when he was young. As you say, he founded this at 20. And at 20, he was a semi-hippie. He loved Bob Dylan. I mean, that was his thing. And I get the idea from reading your book that he was much more concerned about having a human company, about making it work on not just a business level and not just about making lots of money. He wanted it to work for people, and he wanted something more inclusive than just business, right?
Yeah, I think that what you see when he's young is a man sort of who wants to be kind and wants to be human, but can't reconcile that with, you know, his drive to create a great company and to create a great product.
Mm.
Like the two things couldn't go hand in hand there. When he came back to Apple in 1997, he still wanted to create a humane company. He still had these humane ideals,
mm-hmm.
but he had learned how to manage. He had learned how to sort of treat people in a way that made them feel valued. So he's known as a micromanager, but he didn't micromanage everybody. And one of the things that was remarkable for me is when you start interviewing people who had been fired by him their relationships had ended badly, they all said they did the best work of their lives for him. And so he understood the value of great work and how that in itself is a motivational force. While he was away, he spent a lot of time at Pixar, which he owned and which was managed by Ed Catmull. And from Catmull, he learned how to manage creative people over the long haul, how to keep them together and manage them. And that's a skill that he brought back to Apple that he had not had as a young man.
Mm.
So that made it possible for him to take that sort of genius that he had for synthesizing different ideas and technologies and do it steadily over time instead of doing it just for one-off shots like the Mac.
Yeah, well, he grew up, and it was definitely to our benefit in the long run and certainly to his and everyone around him. What was the characteristic that he disliked most in people? I mean, I've heard stories where he fired people in the elevator. He was quick to yell at them. Was it just an inadequacy he disliked in people? Was it if they weren't fast enough, if they weren't kind enough to him, if they didn't?
I don't think there was a deficiency in people that he didn't like. I think he hated to waste time.
Uh-huh.
And he was much less concerned and about manners, about how you behave with people who don't have a big, who aren't a big factor in your life. So he was, his relationships with his close colleagues and his family were as rich and human and complicated and wonderful as, you know, I assume your relationship with your friends and family are. But whereas you might, you know, certainly being on the radio, you have to do this all the time. He actually, it's interesting, I just thought of this, he would have probably been the worst radio host of all time. because you have to listen to people and you have to take their opinions seriously whether you like them or not. And he never would have done that. It would have been like, oh, I got to move on. And he didn't care. He believed in what he was doing deeply. He believed that, and so if you weren't in, you know, providing something interesting, if you weren't helping with that, if he felt you were wasting his time, then he could be very short and he could be very rude.
Yeah, almost like a genius. I mean, that's, you know, the people that I've known that have been genius like that have that same tendency, at least I have observed. In a 1995 60 Minutes interview, he admitted when asked that his weakness was arrogance. And that's probably well put. I mean, obviously it came from him. He knew he had been arrogant, but I guess he had been humbled by the time he went to Pixar, which of course I think he did a brilliant job at Pixar. I mean, I think that really brought his talents in, and you know, in your opinion of knowing everyone you've interviewed and knowing everything about him, do you think that Pixar is what helped him to get to Apple again and do as brilliant as a job as he did?
Yes, I do. I think that Pixar, without Pixar, there would have been no second act at Apple. We would not have had the resurgence of Apple that we, you know, have all benefited from. The thing you have to understand about Pixar is that he really did not run the place. There was a culture already there by the time that he got there. And there was a manager, Ed Catmull, in place who was a brilliant manager and who kept him at bay. And then he saw, and then there was a genius, John Lasseter, who, right, you know, he saw Lasseter develop Toy Story, and he learned how a group of people could work together. There were three. He had, Jobs thought there were three geniuses in his life, they were Johnny Ive, John Lasseter, and Lee Clow.
Okay.
Lee Clow, the advertising guru that he worked with.
I think Pixar just did so much for him, and obviously did so much for us with, you know, what he brought out in Apple years later. And there's wonderful stories in your book, heart-rendering stories of when he got sick and what he did. And we're going to talk about those. I'm going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I want to talk about those because, you know, you make such a wonderful character of who he is. We get to really see who Steve Jobs this book in Becoming Steve Jobs. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment with Rick Taxelli, co-author of Becoming Steve Jobs. We'll be back in just a few here on WTBQ.
Davis Shooting Sports, family-owned and operated.
WTBQ.
Hi, and welcome back to Shannon's Corner. I am Shannon Devereaux-Sanford, and thank you so much for joining us. And don't go anywhere. We are talking with Rick Taxelli, who's the executive editor of Fast Company and has covered technology for two decades. He is also the co-author of the new book, Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader, a brilliant book and a wonderful, wonderful depiction of Steve Jobs. And if you have any, you know, doubts of who this man was, by reading this book, you really grasp who he is. And It is not just such an insight into him, it's an insight into the company, it's insight into humanity. I mean, he was a college dropout, he was a bit of a hippie, was a Buddhist, I believe, as well, and he was driven. As Rick has been telling us, he was driven by success, but he also had an impatience for it, and seemed to just have no patience for, I guess, time or wasting time. And he was, you know, also, the one thing, as I said, he was a college dropout. about. He was an adopted child, and his parents, who had given him up for adoption, was in education, and she made sure, told the parents who adopted him, that he has to go to college. He did for 2 years, and he dropped out. But the thing that really interests me about that is later on, when he had started Next, he talked often about making sure that classrooms had the right computers and education. So he really did believe in higher education, didn't he?
It was a major, it was a huge concern mm-hmm. of his. You know, when he left Apple in 1985, he took five employees with him, including one who had been responsible for setting up Apple's entire network of selling to the education market. At Next, he intended to create a great workstation that was going to bring cheap, high-powered computing mm-hmm. to education. you know, he failed at that, but education was a major, major concern of his. He actually fought for the passage of laws that would encourage, that would facilitate the donation of computers to schools. It was a major deal for his everything in Steve's life is sort of complicated. Education mattered to him immensely. His wife is a philanthropist. She started something called College Track, which helps kids in lower income neighborhoods get on a track to going to college. It's a 10-year commitment to every child. And yet he dropped out of school after 6 months. And, you know, there's something, one of the wonderful things about working on this book was to work on something for a long time and realize that you got to the end and you still have a real complex bundle of facets of this personality. He was a wonderfully complicated guy, and sometimes we try too hard to sort of nail people down. You know, this is the cause of their personality or that.
Right.
But he's a very interesting, complex person.
And he never seemed to really explain himself. You know, he never, felt this need to just describe who he is. As you're mentioning education, as I mentioned, his parents, his birth parents, who gave him away, were both into education. And his sister, Mona Simpson, who he did not meet until he was 25, is a professor. I just, in fact, just recently, about 3 weeks ago, interviewed her on a book that had just come out. They both ended up caring a lot about education, although he was raised, as I said, in a different family who was a working class family. So he took all of that, and as I said, he didn't seem to need to explain it. He just lived who he was.
Yeah, but, you put your finger on something there when you said, he took all of that. If people talk about what was Steve Jobs' genius, and it's often... we often think, oh, he had a genius for design, or he had a genius for picking products out of thin air. And I think what his genius really was the ability to, he had really wide peripheral vision. He took in ideas from everywhere, and ideas from things he read, that things that were in the air, things that people said. And he didn't sort of say, oh, that's interesting, thank you for that, or, recognize things. They just all went in, and they all went into Steve Jobs, and they came out as this confident new opinion. And he could change that opinion all the time, but he was synthesizing. And that's what his genius was. He could synthesize ideas into things the rest of us couldn't imagine.
Yeah, well said. No, that's exactly what you get from reading the book. He was also a multidimensional person. I mean, we always see him as the business person. He was a family man. Even before he was a family man, he had picnics for his staff. He really cared about that. He has an older daughter who he did not have as much closeness with, let's say. She was born, I think, 79 or 80, so before, you know, he was quite young. And then he got married and had three other children, and then he became very much of a family man, right?
He did. He became very much of a family man. My co-writer, Brent Schlender, knew Steve for 25 years.
Right.
He covered him for Fortune in the Wall Street Journal. And he saw this change in the early 90s when Steve started a family. He could see the impact on Steve, the way, you know, family life affects many of us. You know, Steve always, Jobs always regretted what he had done with his first daughter. He had denied his paternity. He had not supported her well at the beginning.
Right.
He tried to make amends, but, you know, that's another part of this man's journey, is that it wasn't perfect. It's not, you know, he was not, as his wife has, as his wife told us many times, he was not a saint by any means.
No, but when he got sick, he was a little bit. I would, maybe a saint is going too far, but although he certainly did have, he was a very almost modest man about being sick. You have the story in your book where Tim Cook offers him his liver, and you can tell us quickly that story.
He did. You know, I think you're right. I mean, I think. Steve Jobs was very courageous, actually, about how he dealt with his cancer. He was very sick in 2009. He was on the verge of death. This was 2 years before he did pass away. And his executives would only visit him at home. He wasn't coming into work at that time. And Tim Cook went to visit him and left one day feeling like he was going to die very soon. And he went out of state, and he took a battery of tests to certify that he could donate his liver to Jobs. He came back, and he said, you know, I can donate my liver to you. It's called a living donor transplant, you know. And Steve sat up in bed and said, no, 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 I'm not going to let you do anything to put yourself at risk. Forget it. And eventually, he did get a liver transplant. But Cook told us that story. I was amazed at the time. There were like four people who knew that.
Right.
He told us that story, and he intended it to show. He said that Steve was not a selfish man. He said, if somebody thinks about their life only in a transactional way, they don't say no to that liver.
No. He was a quiet hero in many. Certainly when he got ill, he was. He had told Bob Iger when they were doing the Disney-Pixar merger that he was sick, and I guess he really left it up to him what they wanted to do. And, you know, I mean, he was very humble about it and didn't seem to. But I think he knew, and I heard him say once, you never know what happens in life, in an interview I had seen, that what's around the next corner. And I think he knew that his time was limited. And maybe that explains a lot more than, you know, when we look at the bigger picture that we see that we did not see then. We only have a few minutes left, and I just want to let everyone know that this is an absolutely wonderful book. You guys have done such a terrific job, you and your co-author, Brent, as you mentioned, Brent Schlender, who knew him and worked with him for years as a writer, and he was close to, I mean, you know, as much as he would be. But he allowed people close to him, and he allowed that brilliance to come through, but it never stood in his way of... how do I say it? Never stood in his way of being who he was. But this book, I just want to say, this book is just a wonderful book. We only have about a minute left. I just want to tell everybody to absolutely get it. It is, you guys have done a great job in looking at him as a person. And it's probably a great read for everybody, but anyone in business or any thinking about going business, it's a must read. It's a beautiful book. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Rick Tetzeli, and also Brent Schlender, who is not with us, but is the co-author of the book, Becoming Steve Jobs. Wonderful book. Everyone should get it. It is terrific. Thank you again, Rick Tetzeli, for joining
us
here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was an honor. Thank you so much. Everyone, we do have to wrap it up for today, but everything is on Shannon's Corner. Just go there. There's a direct link to their website, Becoming Steve Jobs. And until next time, don't forget to make good choices.